Celebrating the latest in the Brookings Institution series of judicial issues forums where we discuss issues of law and policy and politics and anything else that gets within the neighborhood of the judiciary. This time we're proud to be working together with the Progressive Policy Institute, represented here by Will Marshall. And our subject, of course, is entitled Guantanamo Detainees, Is a National Security Court the Answer? And I'm going to talk just a little bit before I get to the answer on the question, before I introduce the panelists. President Obama and his national security team are wrestling with the question of what do we do with the 240-some detainees on Guantanamo who we inherited from the Bush administration, not to mention their counterparts in Afghanistan. And there are, by some calculations, at least three groups at Guantanamo, 80-some at the most, maybe a handful, who could be prosecuted under ordinary criminal law standards, either in military courts or in federal courts. 60-some by the administration, the previous administration's calculations, who are not so dangerous and could be released, but that would leave more than 100, perhaps many more than 100, who are deemed, at least by the military, at least under the prior administration, to be non-prosecutable because of various problems with evidence and standards of proof, and maybe they haven't even committed any crimes, but too dangerous to release. And the hard question is, what do you do with that group, assuming they exist? Some human rights groups, such as the ACLU, sometimes seem to assume there are no such people, and that anybody who needs to be detained can be criminally prosecuted, and that everyone who cannot be criminally prosecuted should therefore be released. The Obama administration so far has, on a lot of detailed issues, gone largely with the status quo, the Bush rules. They're still detaining people on an interim basis. They're still detaining them based on support. They've added the element substantial support for Al-Qaeda or its affiliates. They're no longer going to call them enemy combatants. That was the big flourish last week. No more enemy combatants, which has prompted various conservative cynics to say, well, what should we call them then? Undocumented freedom fighters? Next life enablers? There have been other similar suggestions. But there has been a certain, they seem to be treating them as enemy combatants, even if they're not calling them that. Which brings in the question of, well, how do you apply the laws of war in this situation? And one of several approaches, of several alternatives to the status quo, which we'll hear described in the course of things, is to establish a separate standalone national security court. And that will be the focus of our discussion, but the discussion will deal with a whole range of issues that I just that come up in this context. We have the best panel I could imagine assembling for this, and each panelist will speak for about 5 minutes. Then I will ask questions of them in the same order in which they begin for 30 minutes or so. That should leave another 30 minutes or so for questions from the floor. First will be Professor Jack Goldsmith of Harvard Law School, who served in the Bush administration Justice Department and dealt with these issues, and who is one of the few members of that department who's escaped with his reputation more than intact. He's recently written a paper for Brookings called Long-Term Terrorist Detention and Our National Security Court. And I'd say Jack has advocated something along the lines of a standalone national security court for reasons he will explain. Judge Patricia Wald is to my left, former Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which some would say is our national security court now, de facto, and former Judge of the International Criminal Court for the former Yugoslavia, will speak second, and she is a subscriber to the Constitution Project's report entitled A Critique of National Security Courts. Third will come Harvey Ryshikoff, on my far left, a professor of law and national security studies at the National War College. He's written a number of in-depth articles on the concept of a national security court, the justifications for it, how it would work, and so forth. And last, to my right, Stephen Vladek, associate professor of law at American University Washington College of Law. He, I believe, was the principal draftsman of the aforementioned Constitution Project Critique of National Security Courts. So I think we have a pretty good spectrum of views here. Jack Goldsmith, there you are. Why don't you start off?
Okay, thank you very much, Stuart. So I was asked to be brief, and I will be brief. I want to start off by drawing a distinction. I think that there are two analytically separate issues under the rubric. There are many analytically separate issues under the debate about national security courts, but I want to emphasize two. The first issue is whether we can and should have a regime of long-term detention, military detention, that's not criminal, that doesn't involve trials. This is, I think, the most controversial question. It's a question that asks how we translate traditional wartime prerogatives to detain members of the enemy. Again, how do we accommodate that traditional power to what everyone has to acknowledge are the changed circumstances of this war, the idea that the enemy doesn't wear uniforms, the detention could be indefinite, and the like. On this issue, it seems to me this is the central issue, whether or not the government can and should detain members of the enemy on a non-criminal basis. And the arguments here are well fleshed out, and I won't go into them in detail. It's a question about, on the power side, it seems to me that the president clearly does have the power to do this. And I think that maybe the best statement of this was the brief filed by the Obama administration last Friday, laying out a very robust power to detain members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban and associated forces indefinitely based on a combination of the congressional authorization to use force and the laws of war and traditional presidential prerogatives. We can debate that if you like, but that's one issue about whether there needs to be and should be this long-term detention program that's not based on trials. The analytically separate issue is whether we should have a national security court. And the claim I make in the Brookings paper is that if we have a program of non-criminal military detention, which the Obama administration suggested last week we would have going forward, then by definition we're going to have a national security court. Because there's going to have to be a court that's going to supervise this detention program, either necessarily under the habeas corpus review and probably under some sort of statutory jurisdiction enacted by Congress. And we have, in fact, as Stuart said, a national security court today, and it's in the district court and the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. And it's a de facto national security court, but it's a lot different than the national security court we had until 2004, which was entirely decentralized over the country. After the Rasool decision in 2004, and especially after Boumediene, it's become the accepted practice and custom that all habeas review of detainees will go to the District of Columbia. And we already have a thinly institutionalized but definite national security court. What is a national security court? It doesn't have to be a freestanding new institution. This is the important point. The national security court is a court that's expert in these detention matters and that has special rules needed to deal with these detention matters. And we've already developed special rules, a lot of them judge-made, in the District of Columbia and in the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. And the types of expertise that advocates of a national security court have argued for is developing in the D.C. Circuit. The important question is not whether we have a national security court. We're going to have one if we have non-criminal detention. The important question is who decides what the national security court looks like? Who decides what the rules should be for judges supervising these detentions? And on that issue, I claim right now it has been for 7 years, or 8 years almost, largely the federal judiciary, without any input at all from Congress, and with advocacy from the executive branch, but with the judiciary having the final say. And my final contention is that the ultimate national security court that will prevail, two final points. One is that the ultimate national security court that will prevail in the District of Columbia has to be one in which Congress and the president together, the political branches, the accountable branches, the branches that are supposedly expert in making the trade-offs between security and liberty, or at least accountable for those trade-offs, they need to make the hard calls, and there are a whole host of hard calls that need to be made about the definition of the enemy, about the information that needs to be given, about secrecy, evidence rules, access to lawyers, and the like. All those issues need to be fleshed out by the political branches and not the courts in the first instance, obviously subject to judicial review. And the last point I would make is there's been a red herring about national security courts, and this is implicit in what I've already said, that we need to have a freestanding new institution akin to the FISA court. And I don't think that's necessary, and I don't think it's necessarily a good idea, because there are all sorts of political costs, both domestically and abroad, that would come from creating a new freestanding institution called a National Security Court. We don't need that. We've got one now. It's in this district, and all we need to do is to have slightly more elaborate rules with the input from the political branches.
Thank you, Jack. Judge Walton?
Well, I have a couple of points to make, and the first would be is addressing Jack Goldsmith's main point about whether we should have a what I would call a revolutionary new regime of indefinite detention without the possibility of charges or trial outside of the current laws of war or the current criminal process. And I would say that there a sufficient justification has not been made out for that. And I base that on the fact that we have not only the criminal process, which I admit has some limits to it, but we do have the law of war and we have the Hamdi decision. Now, the Hamdi decision, which said that a person in Hamdi's case who was apprehended in the zone of combat, and there have been several others, can be detained to the end of traditional notions of combat. But actually, under the law of war, and even under the civil rights groups that we hear so much about, are not so intransigent that it doesn't include other people as well. For instance, the papers that I've seen admit that if you have a person in the hierarchical, self-proclaimed hierarchy of Al-Qaeda, et cetera, they too can be, somebody says, I'm out to, you know, I'm part of Al-Qaeda, we're going to get rid of all of you people, that they certainly come within the Hamdi regime. Also, I think there's a convincing case, again accepted by a lot of the civil rights groups, that wherever the military have the right to engage rules of engagement in conflict, even if it's not in a country that we've gone to war with, like Afghanistan, suppose, there is a military, a place where the military is allowed to use force, and say it's in Yemen, or say it's in on the attack on the coal, et cetera, that people apprehended in the course of that can also come under the Hamdi regime. So I think that together with our criminal process, so far I have not heard, now maybe I'm not traveling in the right circles, but I have not heard any U.S. attorney or somebody say, we really want to prosecute that person, but we just can't. I've talked to several judges who have done international terrorist trials. They think they can be done. Sure, they're going to take a little bit more time, and sure, they're going to be a little bit more frustrating. But leads me to my second point. I think before we go down this route of an indefinite detention scheme, which I think is more revolutionary than any that's been seriously considered in the past, I don't think any of the analogs, the civil commitment or some of the other ones, or quarantine, are at all applicable. I think we have to remember our history, and that is whenever we design a system that sounds great, but that really shortcuts the kinds of protections, not just for the benefit of the accused, but for the reliability of the process itself. Whenever we start to go down that route, it goes south. We've only to look at the more recent military commission's experience. I, in regard to another project, have read every decision which has come out by one of the military judges in the military commissions. Admittedly, not many, because only one went to trial. 21 were designated, but there were a lot of interim decisions. And as a judge, both in the domestic courts and even in the international courts, you know, I was overwhelmed as I kept writing. You know, this isn't the way you run a reliable process. So I would be very interested in the fleshing out of the proposals for the National Security Court, what you're going to do different. If it's really going to be looser, I mean, that's what the Military Commissions Act, passed by Congress, did too. I mean, it loosened up a lot of the rules, at least the way it was interpreted by the Military Commission judges. It loosened up privileges against self-incrimination. It loosened up hearsay. It loosened up, certainly, any kind of right of confrontation. I'm perfectly happy to throw my lot in with the D.C., even though the court isn't exactly the way it was when I was there. But I'm willing to throw my lot in with the D.C. Circuit's Article III interpretation currently in the habeas corpus proceedings. And I think there you'll note that even there, like something like 21 or something, people they've already decided there wasn't sufficient evidence against. And there is flexibility in the rules. They've certainly been, but even they have found, and many of the conservative judges have found, that they simply couldn't buy into the kinds of denial of the confrontation. So the last point, only 1 minute, if I've got a minute left.
You got a minute.
I got a minute, okay. In the fleshing out of any national security court, that would supervise, monitor, et cetera, a preventive detention scheme. And I point out that the Obama filing in the court, which I found very surprising, I'll leave it at that, having been an ardent supporter of Mr. Obama all last year, they said, this is just for Guantanamo. We're currently going through a completely, a separate process to decide what we're going to do in futuro. And even this process, they said, is evolving, but here's where we are now. But here are the questions. Who runs this? The military runs this? Does that mean these people are in military facilities? The way you are treated in military, or the things you can do with people in military proceedings, a lot different than you can do when they're in a civilian prison. Can they be interrogated? Once they're put into preventive detention, can they be interrogated by the military or by the CIA? I don't know. We all are, I'm sure, current with the recent revelations of what some of the CIA interrogations were like, and we're hopeful that will not happen in the future. But nonetheless, I think one of Jack's pieces said, well, listen, those Article III judges, they will periodically look it over. How are they going to be in a position to know whether these guys who were not put in because, as I understand it, they were dangerous in your proposal, although that's a real question, is there a dangerousness component to deciding, prediction, to deciding whether somebody goes into the process, or is it simply that they aided in some, as the Obama filing said, some substantial way the Al-Qaeda or Taliban or some other organization in the past? So in the future, these Article III judges, if it ever comes into being, leave the Article III judges, having been one for 20 years, leave them where they are. Don't put them off in a corner and say, this is your full-time work, your national security work. The FISA judges have come and gone, as you know, and it's only part-time. It's an extra, it's an added-on, add-on perk. Yeah. Right. And so if it comes to that, I would certainly hate to see it off in some place in the middle of the country, and I'm not sure you'd get too many volunteers for it. So I'm a highly skeptical on instituting preventive detention. I don't think we have shown the need for it, and I'm really worried about its consequences, including spillover into the regular process.
Thank you. Harvey Ryshikoff, have you been persuaded?
Let me thank the Progressive Policy Institute and Brookings for doing this. I think it's very important that we discuss it and do it in forums like this and even more in-depth forums. As the judges pointed out, that we have to flesh out the issues. The first thing is, I think the distinction between Jack and the judge is the clear sort of threshold question, which was we'll all mention the filings of the Obama administration, because the first issue is, do you think this is a new type of war? Is this a novel type of armed conflict? That was put in the filing. Now, what does it mean to be novel? Which is that this is somehow a hybrid war. And either we can use the traditional institutions to resolve the problem, or we need what Jack has put forward, a functional resolution of the unique set of circumstances and threats posed. And you will have people totally disagree on that threshold question. And how you break on the threshold question will often dictate where you go on this particular issue. Interestingly enough, there's no good clear analogy. Even in the filings that was used by the administration, they used Jack's quote. And Jack's quote is that this is not new, sort of declaring war on persons. We've done it with slave traders, pirates, Indians, the Chinese Boxer Rebellion, and Pancho Villa. And my view is that each one of those analogies doesn't work. And we can go into the debate why each one doesn't work. And I love Jack for having thought through the problem, but these are not pirates. Pancho Villa didn't really have people from Yemen riding with him, to my best knowledge, coming in from other parts of the world. It makes it hard. That's why it's hard. The next point is that there's no good analogy in IHL, International Humanitarian Law, or Law of Armed Conflict. As you know, we're not signatories to Protocol 1 and Protocol 2. There are Protocol 1, Protocol 2 issues that are raised by the dealing with these unique stateless actors. Different countries have been trying to resolve that problem. They have had a comparative experience. What's interesting about the American experience is that there are the countries like France and Israel that have created specialized courts. They've decided that's the way to go, and they have had experience. There have been bad experiences like the Diplock courts, but many democracies confronting this problem have gone through and created a unique, functional, specialized form of adjudication to deal with and experimented with it. Ultimately, there are six choices you have. You can either use a criminal court. You can use our courts martial, which is some of the military want. We've tried to use the military commissions. There are ICC-type courts that could be used. The judges in a perfect perspective to address that issue, whether or not eventually, there's been debate of whether or not the ICC should take up a terrorist jurisdiction. And then there is the local courts. You just leave them in place, which is you don't make it our problem. But the reason why it's hard to do that is, if you look at the filing, you will see that Steve is also involved in an ABA project we call Due Process and Terrorism, where he was a reporter. And what we came out of that particular report, which I recommend to you, is that there are basically six analytical categories of status. And we're really fighting about the status issue and then what you accord each individual status, which you think is due process. And then the fight is, once you've gone beyond that, which entity should be the adjudicator? And I guess the last two points I will make is that we carve up the issue in a way that says, okay, we're looking at detention. But prior to detention, as you know, you have to make a decision of, do you decide to detain or to target and kill? That before you take. And what's happened in Israel, where they've confronted that problem, there's a recent Israeli court decision on targeted killing, and Justice Barak, who's a very thoughtful jurist, has come to the conclusion that you can do it, but he only is going to recognize two categories of status under international law, which is either going to be a combatant or you're a civilian. And if you're a civilian, Justice Barak's position is that what the Israelis must do is first make a determination why they're not going to arrest. Because that's what you do with people who are non-combatants. If you think they're lawful, you have to arrest them. Then, once the decision is made not to arrest, then you make a decision you can kill, and then there's a proportionality problem. And his view, which is quite intriguing, is that the court is involved in that decision, that the court should review those military decisions in order to see whether or not due process is followed. So Jack and I sort of agree and disagree, is that I think the judges should be involved, and I think Congress should be involved in shaping the new forum that we're going to use. But my position, I've been writing about it for a long time, is that the Article 3 solution, as opposed to the de facto solution we're getting now, did not work. And now we are moving towards this in a backward way, and we should be much clearer about it, and we should be much more systematic and structured in creating forums. I'm a member of the ABA Standing Committee on National Security Law, and we're going to start carving out specific forums to say, what are the actual procedural substantive problems for Article 3 judges? How would you resolve that? So it's not loose, because I don't like being particularly in opposition to Judge Wald. I don't mind being in opposition to Steve, because he doesn't have tenure yet. But the idea of looking at it appropriately and keeping an open mind is, I think, what we're talking about, Jack and myself. That's it.
Thank you. Steve Vladeck, batting cleanup. Could you make it all fit together in a harmonious way?
I can try, although as Harvey says, I don't have tenure, so I guess I have to be careful. So let me start with what I think is probably common ground, or at least mostly common ground for all of us. There's a phrase Jack uses in his most recent paper that I think is actually very helpful. He calls proposals for national security courts a canard. And I think that's right, because I think one of the things that the Constitution Project report says is that what we really mean when we say we should have a national security court is we mean to sort of short-circuit the harder questions, probably because they are hard, that we're talking about here, right? The question of scope of detention authority, length of detention authority, et cetera. So I think it's important to start there and to suggest that the real debate is this debate, right? Is what is going to be the government's detention authority? What role is Congress going to play in circumscribing that authority, et cetera? To that point, though, let me add that unlike Jack and Harvey, many of the proponents of national security courts also see them as a useful means for prosecuting terrorism suspects. And I want to suggest that there, it's not just that I think they're unnecessary for reasons that Jack lays out. I think they're actually dangerous. Because if you actually start having a separate hybridized court that simply does specialized criminal prosecutions, presumably using different levels of evidentiary proof, different kinds of substantive offenses, maybe even a different burden of proof, different issue, you know, different rules with regard to access to evidence, access to counsel, I think that's where we start getting much, much more in danger of subverting fairly fundamental values. So it's important to keep in mind that for some people, Andy McCarthy is one example, Glenn Solmazy is one example, Amos Gior is one example. For some of the people who have been the most outspoken in support of national security courts, it's not just about the forum in which we are going to solve these detention questions. It's also about a separate system for prosecutions. And I just want to suggest that I think there are a separate host of problematic questions that go along with that conversation. The other point I would make is, you know, I think Jack is probably right that we have a national security court. I mean, Ben Wittes and I have this, you know, dog and pony show where every time we're on a panel together, you know, I say we shouldn't have a national security court. Ben says we already have one, and we end up agreeing with each other. Right? I think, you know, if we see the current national security court as the D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit, I think that actually to some degree undermines the arguments that we need some new system. Right, at least until we've had the conversation about what reforms need to be made in the context of the current system. And to that end, you know, everyone has their sort of most disturbing decision of the D.C. court so far in the Guantanamo cases. The one that I find the strangest is former Chief Judge Ginsburg's decision this January in Bismullah, where he said that after Boumediene, there's no longer combatant status review tribunal review. Right, that after Boumediene, the only review for the Guantanamo detainees is habeas corpus. They can no longer have the statutory appeal to the D.C. Circuit. I actually think that's unfortunate, because it's one thing for the court to have said in Boumediene that the CSRT appeal isn't enough to satisfy whatever the suspension clause protects. It's another thing to say it might not alleviate the need for habeas review in most cases. Right, it was certainly true that in the Uyghur case, right, in Parhat, the D.C. Circuit in the CSRT appeal had no problem reaching the merits, right, and saying that there was no authority to detain. So I think it's important that if we're going to assume that the D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit are the national security court we're stuck with, there have been some curious things they've been doing that give me pause about having faith that that's the right answer, at least in its current form as well. My last point, and then I think we can turn this into more fighting with each other. We've been talking mostly so far about Guantanamo. And I think it's important to you know, Harvey mentioned the ABA report where we talk about the six different classes of detainees. You know, the reality is that the D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit have become a national security court for Guantanamo only, right? That until and unless something remarkable happens in the Makala litigation with regard to Bagram, there's actually no structure in place right now for judicial review of detentions of non-citizens elsewhere outside the territorial United States. And thanks to the Almari case, there are no longer non-citizens in detention in the United States. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the status quo is not going to work, right? That whatever one thinks of the merits, and I think I'm closer to Judge Wald on this than I am probably to the rest of the people up here, that Congress really is going to need to do something. If not for Guantanamo, given the Obama administration's promise to close it in a year somehow, some way, certainly for everywhere else, because I think, you know, it is not at all clear that Boumediene is going to follow the flag to Bagram. I think the real question is going to be, what do you do with the thousands of individuals who are in U.S. custody elsewhere. So I guess I agree, right, that the real fight here is over preventive detention and what role different groups are going to play and what the outer constitutional and international law limits are. But I'm just, you know, I think I'm less convinced that the way things are right now has a good likelihood of holding.
Thank you. Jack, could you spend a couple minutes responding as you may see fit? And one point I hope you'll address in responding is Judge Wald used the phrase outside the current laws of war to describe what she's concerned about. And I'd love to hear you address generally, can our national security interests in this area be reconciled with international law, or are we going to have to go our own way and say international law doesn't work here?
Okay. On that question, that's one of the questions I wanted to address. I find myself in the surprising and unusual but very happy position of defending what the Obama administration said last Friday, and that is that there's nothing radical at all about detaining members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban pursuant to the congressional authorization and the laws of war. And as Justice O'Connor said in the Hamdi decision, the laws of war clearly and historically have permitted a government to detain members of the enemy until the end of the conflict. It's a traditional prerogative of a wartime. It's uncontroversial, legally uncontroversial, that we're in a war, the one that was authorized by the Congress on September 14th, 2001. The fact that we are in a legal war has been confirmed by Congress twice. The courts, Supreme Court, has said that we're in a war and that triggers the president's military powers. And of course, both presidents, both of our war presidents, President Bush and President Obama, think that. And so there's nothing at all outside the laws of war about the legal position articulated by the Obama administration last Friday. It follows straightforwardly from the laws of war. What makes this unusual and hard, much harder, are two facts. One, this enemy, unlike the 400,000 to 500,000 POWs we had in this country in World War II, without any lawyers or habeas rights or any review at all, unlike those folks, the new enemy, the latest enemy, doesn't wear dog tags, doesn't wear uniforms, doesn't distinguish itself from civilians, and therefore there's a heightened possibility of mistake. And then the second and really fundamental difference is that this war is going to go on for a long time, and we have a hard time figuring out how, even what it looks like to end. Now, neither of those changes that make this war different, in my opinion, undercut the basic rationale that Justice O'Connor articulated and that the laws of war have always articulated about detaining the enemy until the end of the conflict. What they do argue for is much greater procedural protections than the laws of war normally confer on members of the enemy, and that is exactly what the courts have been working out. That's what the Bush administration actually gave these detainees, and the Obama administration is going to give them more, much more than what the Geneva Conventions contemplate. So I don't think that a detention scheme like that, the one that the Obama administration articulated last Friday, is outside the laws of war. They relied throughout the brief, quite accurately and correctly, in my opinion, on the laws of war. Second point I'll make, and I'll stop after this, is just because they have the power to do that doesn't mean they have to do it. Just because they have the power under the laws of war to detain without trial doesn't mean they have to. And it's perfectly open to them at the end of their six-month review, obviously, to say, we have this power, but we're not going to exercise it. But we shouldn't overlook the costs that come from insisting on a trial or release program. And the costs in brief are, one, all the difficulties of proving crimes because of the difficulties of gathering and collecting evidence, the especially difficult problem of revealing sources and methods, and something that we should all face up to, which is in any trial, there's the possibility of acquittal. And that's what makes the trial legitimate. And so the question that the administration, I think, is grappling with probably is, do we want to give up this legitimate power that the president, the commander-in-chief has pursuant to the congressional authorization, pursuant to the laws of war, to detain dangerous detainees? Are we going to give up that power and insist on a trial or release program with all the costs that come from that? And that's the big choice. Just because they have the power to do it doesn't mean they have to exercise it. But I think it's going to be that this administration, like the last one, is not going to want to run the risk of releasing a very dangerous terrorist because of any of the many technicalities that can occur during the trial process.
Thanks, Judge Wald. I think you had a response in the process. I'd also ask you to specify what troubled you exactly about the Obama administration brief last week. And also, there seem to be some questions on the table for the country now. The definition of who can be detained, the burden of proof, what kind of evidence, hearsay, classified, coerced, that some might call legislative questions. Why shouldn't the legislative branch be heard on those questions?
Okay, let me do the international law point first, then we'll move on. I was surprised and, quite frankly, disappointed in the Obama filing. I did not find it particularly convincing on the area of international law. Now, I'm perfectly willing to go along with the fact that, yeah, we have the equivalent of a war with Al-Qaeda, sure. But I will tell you that my understanding of international law is that primarily the Geneva Conventions, et cetera, is that it takes care, it lays down fairly specific rules, but in the case of traditional wars, okay? And I believe that the Hamdi case and Justice O'Connor's opinion said we will take those against the backdrop of those international laws that apply to traditional wars, and we'll apply it in the case of Hamdi to allow the detention. But I read her opinion as having been limited to the area of combat, a zone of combat, the Afghanistan war, which she said, so far as we know, these rules of international law have applied to traditional wars which come to a traditional end, and we don't know about this, but until it's different, we're going to apply the same rules. So I do not agree with the Obama filing if it is interpreted to mean that because of that we can pick up anybody outside of the area of combat and put them into an indefinite detention scheme. Let me just use one example. You've all seen Casablanca, right? And the Great World War II movie. Okay, here you are in a country in northern Africa. America is, let's assume, I can't remember whether the dates are exactly correct, maybe not, but let's assume America's at war with Germany by that time, okay? Sure, Casablanca and the African country is crawling with Germans who are probably in there trying to do things that will be bad for America, that will be fighting against our interest, against our military goals. They had to be swarming. They were all in Rick's Cafe, but they had to be swarming with that. I do not believe that international law in any way affirmatively endorsed the notion that the Americans could have gone in, swooped into Rick's Cafe, kidnapped those people, brought them back to the United States, and put them in a preventive detention scheme. Well, that is, in effect, what the filing seems to say. I hope I'm misreading it, but it does seem to say that. In other words, if somebody, and this I get back to something in Jack's, one of his articles, which starts out my saying, yeah, I mean, it's right, of course, if you have a self-proclaimed person in the hierarchy of Al-Qaeda and Taliban, they should be able to be, if you catch them preventively, detained, or if they've engaged in some sort of direct participation in hostilities in the United States. But then it turns out that he interprets that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jack, he interprets that as meaning somebody who went to a camp. Or somebody who gave some money. We can fight about what's substantial money and not the little old lady who didn't know she was giving it to, but somebody who gave money to it. Not that they haven't maybe committed some sort of crime, but that they can be picked up in the preventive detention scheme and brought back. I don't think international law, I don't know that it forbids it, but I don't think it endorses it. I don't think it's any kind of a natural extension of what has already been said to be within international law and even under the Hamdi. I think that goes only so far as where we're dealing. Okay.
Well, let me just all respond
right,
quickly. First, I think we all agree Vichy France is not the model. So if you look at footnote 12 of the critique, I will read your own words, which was quite fascinating, of the publication that you all have in your packets. And look what it says. It says, O'Connor's plurality opinion stated that even beyond the authority to hold prisoners of war, the government may also detain individuals captured on the field as enemy combatants until the cessation of active hostilities. There is some disagreement among committee members as to whether the Hamdi plurality position
that was
is correct.
Not me. That was not me.
Some committee members find Justice Souter's opinion more convincing. As Justice Souter explained in Hamdi, the government could have detained alleged enemy combatants such as Hamdi as POWs. Because it chose not to do so, Justice Souter concluded the AUMF was an insufficiently clear statement of congressional intent for other forms of preventive detention. However, under the plurality's formulation, the detention is already extended beyond POs only applies to individuals who are captured on the battlefield. As several studies have shown, the percentage of post-9/11 that have captured on the battlefield is comparatively small. This issue of the Hamdi decision and how we stand on it, and the real critical problem of the hard group, which is, I think battlefield detention is actually, of the cases, the more easy case. The hardest case is not on the battlefield, non-US citizen, being scooped up either by us or by another country, and then rendered to us in some fashion. What are we going to do with it? That's the heart of the problem. What is the appropriate due process? And as far as going in, you know, Noriega was someone who I don't think voluntarily came to the country. And the Supreme Court's decision was, well, when we get him, we get him. His position was he wasn't here voluntarily.
But he was going to be put on trial.
It was put on trial, and then we released him, and then he had to be picked up by the Europeans. So it's a very fascinating set of issues of how the international law is being followed, how we're going to engage on it. But I think the really tough issue is the hard case.
And that's right.
And then should that be just Article 3 or should there be something else involved given what the charge is going to be, which will be conspiracy, which is not an overly recognized international crime, not usually frowned upon. And then all the hard questions that you pointed out, what does substantial support mean? What does part of mean? What does associate mean? That's the really hard litigated issue.
And who makes the decision?
And who would make, and but Jack and I think.
Steve, could you address that? And also just to put a little more concrete meat on the bones, I suppose that's a mixed metaphor. Take Salim Hamdan, who was the driver for Osama bin Laden and ferried weapons around and so forth, and who was prosecuted, as you know, in a military commission. Suppose they hadn't prosecuted him in a military commission. Suppose the question is, can he be detained long term, or can a Taliban foot soldier who might return to the fray in Afghanistan be detained long term? How should that question be answered, and who should answer it?
Well, I mean, I think those are related, right? You know, Harvey says that it's the hard cases. I mean, I think no one's going to disagree that the hard cases are the ones that make the bad law, right? I think we have to be careful that there are really two different questions here. The first is, what do the laws of war require/permit, right? The second is, to which cases do the laws of war apply? Right, there's an assumption that pervades a lot of the discussions in this area that the laws of, you know, it's one thing to characterize the laws of war and to say that under the laws of war, you know, you can hold for this long, you can hold without these procedures, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing to assume that the laws of war apply to every single person who we're picking up in the context of the military force that Congress authorized in September 2001, right? I don't think it's at all clear that in the context of a non-citizen who's picked up, let's say, on the streets of Sarajevo, not by us, right, who is only indirectly turned over to us, that the laws of war would apply. They might, right, and they might not. But I think that, you know, we have to be careful to resist the assumption that they do, because I think that's where we get into trouble. With Hamdan, and I should say, I think this is in my bio, I worked on the Hamdan case, so I may be biased. I am biased. Although, you know, find me a sort of a lawyer in D.C. who didn't somehow work on one of these cases at some point. With Hamdan, I think it's important to realize, I mean, Hamdan was captured in the context, you know, quote, on the battlefield, right? Well, he was captured in...
At a border crossing.
But in Afghanistan.
Then, but a border crossing, yeah.
I mean, but he's captured in Afghanistan, right? This is not a case like Hamdi, where there was a reasonable allegation that he was only picked up and turned over to the U.S. because of a bounty that the U.S. was paying to the Northern Alliance. I actually think Hamdan's case on the pure laws of war detention question is a close one. And I think, you know, I think the government would have been in much better straits in Hamdan's case had they actually held on to him. Indeed, if the government really believed that Salim Hamdan posed a threat, detention would have been much better than a military tribunal because he'd still be at Guantanamo as opposed to free in Yemen, having served, you know, 7 months in prison after his military commission. So I guess the larger point here, right, is that I think we have to be careful not to speak in generalities. Right, the laws of war, I think, we would all agree that the laws of war do permit detention of people who are properly classified as combatants, of people who receive those procedural protections that the laws of war require. Right, where I suspect we will disagree, and where I suspect many of us will disagree, is to whom the laws of war apply. And I'm less bothered by the notion that, that the laws of war would apply to Hamdan than I am that they would apply to someone captured in far less specific circumstances.
Jack, to pick that up, address any part of that you'd like, but also the Bosnians, Boumediene himself, and several other Algerians, I think, who had become citizens of Bosnia, were picked up by Bosnian security forces, handed over to the United States, held at Guantanamo, recently found not detainable by Judge Leon based on not there being not much evidence. Suppose hypothetically that the government had a very convincing intelligence information from Bosnian intelligence that this guy was trying to blow up the U.S. evidence embassy, but they don't want to give it over to the court. How do you handle that?
Well, so legally, the way you would think about it, the fact that someone wants to blow up the U.S. embassy by itself does not give us detention authority. Again, I go back to the Obama filing. Under that rubric, you'd have to show that they were doing so either as a member of al-Qaeda or the Taliban or as an associated force or a co-belligerent. I don't know enough about the facts to know whether they satisfied the criteria, but if they didn't and if the government couldn't show that, then they would not have the authority to detain, and of course they could try them if they wanted to.
No matter how dangerous.
Yeah, this is not a freewheeling. I'm not proposing, the Obama administration is not proposing, I don't know anyone recently who's proposed, seriously,
no.
A freewheeling authority to detain someone just because that person is deemed dangerous. There's a strict legal test, is what has Congress authorized and what do the laws of war traditionally permit? And there's lots that's black and white about that, and there's lots of gray that needs to be worked out, but that is the framework for understanding this. But let me just say one other point. I don't think that this distinction between, again, I agree with the Obama administration, that this distinction about on the battlefield, off the battlefield is not coherent. Congress authorized the use of force against an enemy that attacked us inside the United States. The battlefield was in a very real sense here. They said that they wanted to prevent that from happening again. The enemy is spread out all over the globe, and we've been attacking the enemy all over the globe, using military authorities authorized by Congress all over the globe. The question is, there are two sets of questions. One, can we go after those people consistent with jus in bello, the laws of war, and consistent with the congressional authorization? I think the answer to that is yes, but there is a separate question about jus ad bellum, whether we can enter another country and do so. That's a separate analytical question. But this idea that there's the battlefield in Afghanistan and you can detain people there, but people you pick up elsewhere, you can't detain under the laws of war, I don't think is correct.
Is that a categorical distinction? I mean, I guess at least what I may have misspoke then, because I'm not suggesting that there's no authority to detain off the battlefield. I'm just suggesting that the questions are different, right? That when you have someone who's picked up by the Bosnian security forces, right, there may be a more plausible claim in that case, right, that it's, you know.
I think that the government's proof is the same. The government has to show that no matter who picks them up, and maybe that makes the government's burden greater since we didn't pick them up ourselves and has a chain of evidence problem. So maybe that increases the government's factual, what the government has to show. But the question is, has Congress authorized force against this person? Is this person part of a group against which Congress has authorized force? And if so, the president can detain that.
Well, let me just jump in. That issue is, first on the Hansen cases, you know, there were two sets of problems. One was the chain of evidence, because the RPGs were put in a place in which we didn't tag. And then second of all, circumstantial evidence, which was the videos. And that's what's the core of the case. And when you put that in front of a jury, the jury found that evidence somewhat underwhelming because of procedural issues.
Which case are you talking about?
Hamdan.
Hamdan.
Now, the second issue is where there's also convergence, and it's been raised, and I'd like to hear both the judge, Mamie, and Jack on this, is that the big problem is DPIH, direct participant in hostilities. That's a big problem that we're having in international law. We have this whole problem, because Hamdan, in a way, could be a private contractor. He could have said, look, I just got hired to drive this guy around and occasionally asked me to put stuff in the trunk. But I'm not somehow involved in al-Qaeda. I'm not somehow involved in associational. I'm sort of like Blackwater, now Z. I was hired to be a driver. So the DPIH, in the context of where we are with the type of enemy, is the original Jack, I think, judge debate. Is this a new novel type of war, which then allows there to be new types of targeting, new types of capture, or are the traditional, historic Article III, classic POW category sufficient? I think that's where the line breaks.
Can I just
please do, and then I had a specific question to ask you.
I agree with Harvey in the lines he's drawing on the debate. But here's the way the world looks from my point of view, is we did have international law and it covers certain parts of the relationship between countries. It certainly was not created for this particular kind of war, although Protocol 2 and various things you might bring in, but it wasn't, and it's limited, admittedly. But what we are seeing proposed, and where it's limited, countries have to fill in the gap for themselves. I admit, if the international law doesn't cover some critical part, then our national legislature goes in and does it. But when we're deciding what it can do, according to our own constitution, according to our own traditions, I think I am just kind of amazed at the scope both of what is being proposed here when we get down to nuts and bolts and what is being proposed in the Obama situation, because basically what we are saying is when Congress decides that Al-Qaeda, not just Al-Qaeda, but Taliban, but in the future there may be other organizations, it specifically says that. We're not limited to those organizations. Mm-hmm. When we decide that these organizations, it could have been, from my point of view, being the oldest person in the room, it could have been the communist conspiracy of the 50s or 60s, which was out to under, by some interpretations, was out to parts of it to do away with us by sabotage, sure. Revolutionary That's means. Fair. It means we can then go in any part of the world, pick up anybody, it's not a citizen, et cetera, take them back, not using the normal extradition or those kinds of means, bring them back here. Even that, I know we have the case in California which says that's okay under our Constitution. So leave the rendition part out for a minute, okay? That may be a separate question. Bring them back here for what? For a trial as to whether or not they really were doing that, whether the kid who went to the I'm not trying to minimize it, but the kid who went to the training camp and then later on he said, oh, that's not for me, I'm going back to school, and never pursued it any further, whether or not they can be then put in a preventive detention scheme and held, I don't know how long, indefinitely or whatever. I find that just a quite an overwhelming concept. And one I think is very much not an extension of either international law as we know it or our own law. I think that how we do that, even the protections that Jack talks about, if it is, and in your article you say they would have habeas, I think, in one of your articles. I'm trying to figure out what the habeas they have, according to a preventive detention scheme outlined by Congress, but it seems clearly implicit that they're going to get less of a habeas. They're going to get habeas light or something, because otherwise, you know, why have the special court? And does habeas light mean we don't want to, we're afraid to show certain classified information kinds of things, a legitimate concern. But what it's going to come down to is somebody, and it's going to be a prosecutor or it's going to be a military person, after they've picked up that person around the world someplace, is going to decide, am I going to put this guy into the preventive detention track, or am I going to put him into a regular criminal case track? And I think that decision and how it's made, like Barack, I have, you know, real concerns about that, because I don't see where the incentives are going to be, especially if somebody says, oh, we can't put that guy to trial because we'd have to show this.
Could I ask something specific on that point? No, because I think you made it clear if we catch an Al-Qaeda guy with a gun in Afghanistan in 2001, he's detainable.
Sure.
If it's Rick's bar in Casablanca, not detainable. Presumably Bosnia, not detainable. Right now, every few days, the Obama administration is shooting a missile into Pakistan to kill a bunch of Taliban, alleged suspected Taliban leaders. A, is that illegal? And B, what if instead of...
That's outside my job description.
Okay.
You're not paying us enough for this.
What if instead they send a commando team across, they grab the Taliban leaders instead of killing them, and then they put them in Bagram Air Force Base or bring them back to the United States? I mean, and I guess I'm trying to get a feel for, is there a line somewhere? The battlefield guy in Afghanistan versus somewhere between him and Rick's bar.
Yeah, no, I know on a real life level, sure, the notion is if you can shoot a guy, and look, I'm not an expert on what you can do under use bello in those circumstances, whatever. I only get them after they're brought into court. And so I can't answer
Dead
that.
Dead men file no habeas corpus petitions.
I can't answer that. The answer that question. But what I do have the sense is if you do capture them, and well, for one thing, I won't even get into the fact of whether or not it's in the borderline of Pakistan, whether or not that could be defined as a combat zone, et cetera. I think that's a close question too. But if we grab somebody someplace, and he isn't in the combat zone, and he isn't in any kind of direct participation in an act of hostility against the United States, and that they were back into the hard cases.
Yeah.
I think the hard cases belong in some form of regular court procedure, and I think we have the weapons. You saw what happened to Al-Mari. They went all the way up to the court. That when I, in honesty, had something to do with the Al-Mari case too. So. And Al-Mari, they went all the way up, and then finally it just got too sticky, so they brought him back to the civilian courts where he had been in the first place. They filed a two-page, as I understand it, I haven't actually read it, I read about it, a two-page indictment which said he's being indicted for conspiracy to materially, or whatever the right word is, substantially, materially aid the enemy kind of thing. There's no question we have enough laws on the books. So it then becomes a question, why can't we do the regular trial? And there are only two reasons I've seen written by anybody. One is the evidence might be tainted. Well, we know everybody, including the Obama administration, says we're not touching torture. Torture is out. We don't like torture. It's gone. So theoretically, that shouldn't be it. The next question then is short of torture, coercion, inhumane, Article 3 type treatment. So theoretically, maybe we don't want to bring somebody to trial because of that kind of thing, or we don't want to disclose certain amounts of classified information. We don't think CIPA, Classified Information Procedure Act, is sufficient to do it. That bothers me a little bit if that is going to be the linchpin of whether somebody goes into one track or the other. Is does the prosecutor think that it might be a hard trial or it might be too difficult to try? Is he going to be allowed to make that decision? And if so, what are the incentives? Already we know that in some past cases the prosecutors have suggested two people being regularly tried while we had the enemy combatant track in place. Look, if you don't plead guilty, you know, you may end up being an enemy combatant. Imagine if you've got this track where you can just put them there to begin with every time you don't want to disclose the classified information.
Jack, and Steve, please address that. And also, Jack, you mentioned in your latest paper the Massawi trial and the Padilla trial, which have some resemblance to the Al-Mari case just mentioned because they ended up in the criminal justice system. And I think you thought there were problems there.
Right, so this is one cost of, it's just one cost in the mix when you're trying to decide, make the policy question. And it's a policy call, and it's a hard policy call about which trials to use, how often to use them, what the rules should be, and the like. And one consideration is, this invariably happens, is that there's going to be, if we use the regular civilian trials to try the terrorists, as we saw in Massawi, as we saw in Padilla, there's going to be inevitable pressure by prosecutors because of the difficulties of proving the crimes of stretching concepts beyond their normal place. So in Massawi, we had some adjustments, to put it mildly, to the confrontation rights of the defendant. In Padilla, it was a shockingly broad conception of conspiracy that that allowed him to be prosecuted. Those are precedents in the civilian courts that can be used for every defendant, theoretically. And that's one of the problems. There's spillover from terrorist trials to trials of other defendants. That's just one of the many costs one has to consider when deciding whether to use civilian trials. That argues perhaps for using UCMJ procedure, where the precedents, I think, can be more cabined, at least the non-constitutional precedents. And so.
Steve, when you address any of that, but also when you work through all the complexities here, is the bottom line that there are going to be a lot of dangerous people that just have to be released because there's no legally sufficient basis for holding them, or is it something else?
I think it's something else. I mean, I think, you know, the suspicion, and I think to some degree this is consistent with statements the Obama administration has made, is that they're going to try to find other remedies for as many of the Guantanamo detainees as they can, and then see how big the group is who's left, right? And so, you know, where it's possible to repatriate detainees to their home countries, perhaps for trial there, they'll do that. Where it's possible to pursue criminal charges against them in the United States, you know, they may do that. And then you see how many people are left. And I think, I mean, this is where I perhaps part company with some of my friends, but I think that there is room for Congress to come back and to create some kind of framework detention statute for those hard cases, right? Because I would add one category to Judge Wald's description, right? There's also the cases where the evidence may not be inadmissible, right? Where the evidence just may not be enough to prove in a criminal proceeding. And yet the government has enough information that they know that releasing this person is a real threat. And to me, when we talk about the hard cases, that's the hard case, right? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to me is not the hard case, right? The hard case is the case where you have a minor guy who we have pretty good reason to believe is up to no good, right? But who we really can't prove that to any, you know, neutral fact finder. And the problem in that case is, what kind of precedent does it set if all those people are detainable? So that's why I think the better way forward is a more detailed statute, right, that has a clear definition of who can be detained, that has regular review, right, that provides access to counsel, right? I mean, you know, I think the problem is that too much has been left up in the air. I mean, if you read the AUMF says the president has the authority to detain all persons, organizations, et cetera. He determines. Right, we're already past the text of the AUMF because it's not the president who's determining this anymore. It's the courts, and I think I actually think that, you know, it's better to have the courts doing something here. But I think, you know, there's a lot of room for Congress to come back and actually provide a far more lucid and far more useful definition, whether or not it's consistent with the laws of war for who can be held.
Two quick questions for you and Judge Wald, and then I'll go to the floor. Do you share Judge Wald's concern about the Obama administration brief filed last week? And also, Judge Wald, how about that? How about Congress getting into the act? As Steve just suggested.
I mean, I'm not quite as worried about Friday's brief as I am about Thursday's. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a decision out there in the case of the Uyghurs called Kiemba. And the Uyghurs, you know, is a very hard case because here you have 17 Chinese Muslims who have been determined by the D.C. Circuit to be not detainable as enemy combatants, who cannot be sent back to China because they credibly fear persecution and torture there. And so the question becomes, what do you do with those guys? Now, one could treat the Uyghur case as sui generis. The problem is that the Obama administration isn't, right? That the administration has now invoked the D.C. Circuit's decision in the Uyghur case as support for the proposition that none of the Guantanamo detainees is actually legally entitled to a court order releasing them. And so I find that position far more troubling than the intermediate view of who can be detained in Friday's brief. Let me just throw one last thing on top of that. In talking about criminal trials, I actually think the even worse precedent is the Abu Ali case. Right? We talked about Moussaoui, we talked about Padilla. In the Abu Ali case, you really saw, I think, what Jack was referring to insofar as stretching the procedural rules in a terrorism case. But I don't know that that in and of itself is an argument in favor of some specialized process. I think that may just be an argument that there are constitutional limits that should be observed in all of these cases. No, but right? And that's where we go back to Congress.
Part of the issue is which the judge is concerned about is prosecutorial discretion, because that's the decision, that's a strategic decision made by the state. But the second issue, where the analogy is look what's happening in piracy. We had thought that we'd resolve that problem. Well, piracy's come back with a vengeance. And one of the problems of piracy, which is that if you want to use, which we were talking about earlier, the Al Capone approach, you use other types of statutes to get the person, which I think is the position of the Article III. The problem with the piracy issue using the Al Capone approach is why the Brits and the Dutch were using a catch and release program is their fear was if they actually captured the pirates, brought them back to their jurisdiction, they could only try them, the charge would be only about 10 years. then they would have, after 10 years, they'd have to release them either into Holland or England. They didn't want to do that. They found that that would be a huge problem for them, so they put them back onto the water. And that's because there's a refoulement doctrine under international law, which is you cannot return someone if you fear they're fearful. So there's an extraordinary gap there, and that is not being filled either by the international regime or the domestic regime. And in a certain way, that's your hard case. The Uyghurs fall into that gap, and there's going to be more of that as a potential problem.
I guess I just find it ironic that at the end of the day, the reason why we are supposed to be not as concerned about a specialized process in these cases is because the criminal justice system is too harsh and the rules are stretched too much. I mean, you know, I don't disagree with the statement that the criminal justice system is too harsh and that the rules are stretched, but I don't think that's limited at all to terrorism cases. And so, you know, if we want to have the separate conversation about, you know, making sure that we're actually not adopting these overly broad evidentiary rules, I mean, I worry that we keep sort of, it's a moving target, right, that we keep using the deficiencies in one system that are not necessarily terrorism specific, right, to argue for why the other system is more appropriate, and that's why people on both sides are often seen as talking past each other.
Let's get questions from the floor as soon as you respond.
Okay.
And also, is there a role for Congress here, do you think?
I'll get to that. All right, I two quick points. One, the spillover works both ways. You worry about, and maybe justifiably, about stretching the ordinary rules of criminal justice too much in order to encompass a new kind of, and that may be a legitimate rule. I worry about, I am a moviegoer, as you know, I don't just watch Casablanca, I watch old movies called The Field of Dreams. And build the field and they will come, is I worry too about when you have this separate process that will be so much more attractive to the decision makers about which goes in than trying to either go in the criminal process or stretch the rules. I don't think the Al Capone thing is so bad.
I know.
My feeling is Almar was originally up for several, I don't remember them,
Credit
but they
were,
they,
for,
yeah, 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 okay. So you put him away.
Your
I mean,
wife,
if,
right?
Okay, no, all right, that's that. Congress can come in and decide penalties. I'm not against Congress making penalties on criminal process, what it thinks are the legitimate ones. To me, that is less harmful to the whole future of our rule of law than creating this amorphous. Do I think there's a role for Congress? Of course. The AUMF can never, we can't operate underneath that indefinitely, no matter what we do, no matter which way we go. And if Congress, you know, wants to clarify who can be detained, et cetera, I don't have any problem with that. I have some skepticism based on the Military Commission Act. I, along with hundreds of others, testified before Congress, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think what came out at the other end, now we have a different Congress, maybe it'll be better this time. My bottom line concern, if you haven't guessed it yet, is that to create a whole separate track which is making different decisions according to different rules and putting people away for the indefinite future is something I think is really quite revolutionary and something we have to think really long and hard about.
Any questions from out there? Yes.
David Richter's Cato Institute. I'd be wondering, would beefing up the military end of determining status alleviate some of these problems? Like if we were to take the competent tribunal standard in Article 5 and move it more towards the judicial tribunal standard for actually trying these and essentially using a military judge for basically habeas light being habeas by a military judge and using that as a screen, would that alleviate some of the concerns before it moves to an Article 3 form?
Jack, do you want to address that?
I don't have concerns about using the Article 3 form. So, I mean, it's a hard question to answer in the abstract. There are trade-offs. I think the C-cert is not a process that a lot of people have confidence in. I haven't actually studied it in detail. I think we need, this is a vague answer to a somewhat vague question, I think we need a process that maximally ensures accuracy, that we have the person who has done the things that we think that he has done to bring it within the legal standard. And if that requires ratcheting up the procedural demands and the showings at the first level stage, I think that's a, one of those contextual calls that Congress should make.
But you know, under Boumediene, the only thing that was declared unconstitutional was 7A, which is the habeas issue. The rest of the act stands, so that's often at B. You still confront the same problems. You're going to still have what we've been discussing all morning, these very hard, hard cases. And my sense is, for strategic reasons, you don't want to have the military system. I have the highest respect and I teach JAG officers. And the JAG officers stood extraordinarily tall during this whole 7 or 8 years. But I think it's not something that they want. If you have to move to the full courts martial, it's a different set of problems. So my sense is why many of us have said, either you're going to use the Article 3 or you're going to use a new form of the national. That's what we. That's what the consensus is, at least on the panel.
Steve, is that your view, or do you think there's a role for military courts here?
I think there's a role for military courts in those cases. I mean, assuming that these are cases we agree are properly dealt with in the military paradigm. I think it's important to remember one thing about Boumediene, right? Justice Kennedy's concern in Boumediene was not with the CSRTs in the abstract, right? His concern was with the confinement of the D.C. Circuit's ability to review CSRTs, right? So I actually think there's room in Boumediene, in those cases where that kind of procedure is appropriate, to craft some kind of military review process, so long as you are not tying the hands of the Article III judges who will inevitably sit in review of that process, right? I mean, I think what was really offensive to the court in Boumediene, to the majority in Boumediene, what was offensive to Scalia was the majority in Boumediene, but what was really offensive to the majority in Boumediene was not the CSRT process itself, but the way that the Detainee Treatment Act circumscribed and actually tightly confined the power of the D.C. Circuit to review the CSRTs, and I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Actually, just many of the civil rights groups, or the civil liberties groups, however, special interests, however you want to call them, were very positive toward a kind of Article 5 proceeding. Now, they were thinking of it in terms of the Afghanistan battlefield, bombing, zone of combat, sorting out, pointing out that, if I recall, something like 1,000, it was used in Vietnam, and over 1,000 people were let go right then and
You're
there.
Talking by about the, Article 5.
Yeah, the
Article 5. The Racket Stack
Geneva
issues.
Convention.
Geneva Convention.
Sorry, military.
Correct. Correct.
Military.
Yeah. Correct.
Which is a hearing on the
very
which
loose
is
battlefield.
A hearing very on the battlefield to, to single out prisoners of war, people claiming a prisoner of war status versus somebody who doesn't have it. But in the process, the guy who was taking his lambs to pasture, whatever it is.
Or the National Geographic reporter.
Right. Got 1,000 of them got let go right then and there. And so the group, and some of those, I won't say how many, some of those 1,000 that didn't get let go or whatever in Afghanistan ended up in Guantanamo. I'm not talking numbers because I don't know numbers, but some of them did. So I think there may be, in terms of that kind of thing, a role, but it was always felt, I think, by the groups that I talked to or worked with, that you needed the Article III subsequently.
Somewhere, right.
Somewhere.
Which is absolutely
subsequent.
This was a
sorting out, right, at the
it's
field.
It's a rack and stack.
Now, there's one exception, right? I mean, there's a curious provision in the Military Commissions Act that I think no one ever talks about, which allows for the trial by court-martial of a lawful enemy combatant, as defined by the Military Commissions Act. Right now, on at least what was the Bush administration's view, you know, we've yet to see whether this will also be the Obama administration's view, no one detained in the conflict against al-Qaeda is a lawful enemy combatant. But right, Congress has actually already provided for court-martial proceedings, at least in some of these cases.
Additional. Yeah.
More questions from the floor? Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Jim Arcadis from the Progressive Policy Institute. If I could, since you're all lawyers, we've gotten into a lot of nitty-gritty, and I think that the discussion is fractured a little bit. On the one hand, there's this question of should we have a national security court, and then the discussion has also gone into what are the laws for detaining. So I think I'd like to crystallize, maybe take a brief poll of the panel, and talk about three issues that seem to really get at the heart of what we're talking about. So when we pick up people on the battlefield and the rules of detention are poorly defined and we're not sure what scenario they exactly fall into, if I could have briefly each of the panelists discuss what are the trade-offs here? In your view, is it better to hold these people without trial or in the due process of law? What serves the best interest of American national security to either afford them the best traditions of due process or hold them without any sort of due process. Secondly, how long should we be holding these people if we are to afford them due process? And then the third issue is, what form should the due process best take?
You want to take that on,
left
just
to right.
going left to right?
Well, clearly, when you give it an easy case, if they're picked up on the battlefield and they're in a firing situation, that's an easier case. So you say, of course, we can hold them. The question is, do you want to use a traditional, if they're a, quote, lawful combatant, you have a decision to make whether or not you want to use classic military justice. If they, quote, do not follow Geneva Conventions, our whole position is that you should be able to bring them to some form of prosecution. Should that be the traditional Article 3? Should that be the National Security Court? Should that be a traditional military commission? But I think most of all agree, as you can hold them, that there's going to be a parole system. We've had that repeatedly while you're detaining. You have a system in which you have a 6 or yearly meeting in which you meet with the individuals detained and ascertain whether or not they're a threat or not or continue to be a threat or not. And then you make a determination. And then the last question is, that's what this is about. Your view that it's disjointed, to crystallize, is they're connected. That's why it's so complicated. It's not disjointed. The issue is how we detain as a strategic manner and which forum we use has a significant impact on how we understand the rule of law, how we understand due process, and how we think we're doing just deserts to the people that we're fighting and are fighting us.
Judge Wong,
yeah.
Thoughts on that?
I'm basically in agreement with you. If you pick them up in the battlefield or in the zone of combat, you can have an Article 5 just for your own sake to get rid of the clearly innocent people. But you can certainly, you don't have to have a trial on the battlefield. You can certainly take them over to a holding place, hopefully not Guantanamo, but some kind of a holding concern. At some point, I think you then do have to have some kind of a CSRT. I know Boumediene didn't get to it, but certainly there were some hard cases to be made that the form of the CSRT was pretty bad. And hopefully it would be one that had some more, not a full-scale trial, but some more. You weren't chained to the floor.
Just for anyone who's not sure, the CSRTs are the
combatant status reform. They were run by military people. People were shackled to the floor. They never knew what the charges were ahead of time. They didn't really have any right to a lawyer. They were pretty bad. Okay.
But how do you really feel?
And so I think, but you know, you made it easy for me at least by talking about the having been picked up in the battlefield. Which struck me. How long can they be detained? That's a hard question because some of these, we'd all hope Al-Qaeda will go out of business in another 10 or 20 years, but probably not, or there may be some other group in the media. That's very hard question of how you apply traditional things at the end of the war to that. I don't have the answer.
As an example, in the Afghanistan, there's going to be three systems that we're operating under. You're going to have, if it's picked up by ISAF, the International Force, they have 96 hours to make a decision to turn that individual over to an instruction, we call them the judge of instruction, because they're a civil code system. If they're picked up by the Afghanis, they have the decision to make within 72 hours, they have to give it to because it's a speedy issue, in order to make an investigation for a reference to be made by that judge. If we decide that that somehow you're dealing with a non-Afghani, a foreign citizen who we have not declared war with, we're not at war with because there's no state of war, then the decision that's made is whether or not we're going to hold that person, because who's captured them, and then what are we going to do with them? So that is what the military is struggling with, because you're under three possible regimes in order to have that detainee, and we're deploying Marines right now in the Helmand province as part of the surge, and that's going to be a real problem for them. Which regime are they under? How much time do they have? And what should be the process? And what's the nationality of the person that they're capturing? Because you can always keep them in place. Afghanistan has a criminal system. Iraq has a criminal system. It's that other group that we're dealing with when you say capture on the battlefield. That's why we had the six categories. Because you don't know what you're dealing with. There's three categories in each one of the battlefields.
Let's see if there are other questions. I know we haven't quite finished the poll, but yes, a question back there. And then we'll marshal.
Hi, I'm Nina Crowd. I'm director of the Center for International Free Expression and a local human rights and criminal defense lawyer. I wonder whether the panel could inform us about what other nations are doing in relation to capturing terrorists. Spain comes to mind. Germany comes to mind. England certainly comes to mind. That also have troops, I think, in Afghanistan. I don't know whether they've declared war the way we have. Regardless of the Supreme Court's decisions, I don't believe this is a real war. But nevertheless, how have they handled people who have been captured, whether in their countries or elsewhere, in their either military or judicial systems? And whether or not that can inform, whether that can inform us as to how to handle our situations.
Steve, are you equipped to answer
that? I can talk a little bit about it. I mean, I'm probably going to mess up some of the specifics, but at least in Afghanistan, what has been true is that, I mean, Harvey described, I think, accurately the choices that everybody faces. And those countries that have been involved in detention operations, it's a dwindling list, have mostly either created their own processes or have, turned them over to us. I mean, really, in Afghanistan and Iraq, the predominant model has been to give the people to us if they're not giving them to the domestic authorities and let us deal with it. So it really has become our problem. There are, however, fascinating comparisons to draw with how our various, friends overseas are dealing with domestic terrorism suspects. England has these things called control orders under the Anti-Terrorism Act of 2001 and various amendments thereto that are, I think, much more aggressive than what we currently have on the books insofar as what it allows the government to do with regard to length of detention, with regard to standard for detention, with regard to lack of, trial, but which also have time limits and have a deliberative judicial review. Now, there's been debate among, I think, the human rights community about how rigorous those time limits are and how flexible they are. But I actually think that if Congress were looking for an example either of what to do or what not to do, the control orders under the Terrorism Act would be a place to start. Not because they're perfect, but because they're at least one example of a country that has tried to figure out how you might do at least short-term detention of terrorism suspects.
How about Germany and Spain? Does anyone on the panel know how they're handling these issues? I think they were mentioned.
The French judge Bouger, remember, was the terrorist judge. So the French were handling it by having a specialized judge who's a cross between being a prosecutor and the FBI because he has his own control. And that's the French model. The Progressive Policy Institute paper has some description of what Judge Bruguière's powers are. But people feel the French have been quite aggressive on this issue and have had a long term with it. But under the Civil Code, we give those judges even more power if they're a special judge.
There's also, just going back to the due process question, because I think, one of the important questions is going to be, if we're all in agreement that Congress can and maybe even should do something, right? One of the questions is going to be, how will the Constitution limit what Congress does? I mean, there are actually a series of, one could see the litigation post 9/11 as knocking off World War II era precedents one at a time, right? I'm trying to be funny and not working. but so there's actually, there's a case from 1948 called Ludecky versus Watkins, which is about detention under the Alien Enemy Act. And the Alien Enemy Act, which is still on the books, allows for the detention and deportation of nationals of countries with which we're at war, right? So during World War II, we held non-combatant German civilians and Italian civilians who were in the United States under the Alien Enemy Act. And in 1948, the Supreme Court, in a very, very bitterly divided 5-4 opinion, says not only is the Alien Enemy Act constitutional and not violating due process, but the war isn't over, right? This is 1948. I shouldn't have to go through too much history to point out the oddity of saying in 1948 that the war against Nazi Germany wasn't over, right? The court says the war isn't over for due process and detention purposes until the political branches say it is. And that didn't happen in Germany's case till 1951. So the precedent out there actually seems to give Congress certainly more leeway than I'd be comfortable with. But there's a lot of room here, and I think the notion that due process might provide the limit on the duration of detention is something that actually is I think the right way to think about it, but we're not there yet insofar as understanding how the cases all work.
Will Marshall, question?
Thanks. Just two quick questions. It seems clear that there is not much international law that covers the case of the people we're talking about here. Terrorist conspirators, maybe in Al-Qaeda, but maybe affiliated with other groups. And in the absence of that, I'd like to know, is it the position of those who are skeptical about national security courts that such people, when picked up, should be presumptively entitled to the full panoply of constitutional protections that an American citizen enjoys? And for the supporters, or those who lean toward this security court idea, what is the principal advantage? How does it help us balance security and due process and civil rights protections or civil liberties protections better than the existing civil court system?
Judge Wald, do you want to?
Okay. I think the people we pick up, if we picked them up in a context of being a direct participant in hostilities against the United States, then I think they are covered by, I think, correct interpretations of international law, and I think that they could be detained under the Hamdi decision with whatever surveillance or oversight we want to give the Hamdi detainees. I still am stuck with the notion that if you're picking up people in foreign countries that we're not at war with, and they have not been what we call direct participants in hostilities against the United States, the Obama people reject that particular standard in their filing, then I think skipping over how you get them to the United States, because that's a whole different thing, then I think once we get them here, yes, we ought to try them under our criminal laws by our regular criminal process. I think to set up some kind of different thing where we pick up people, bring them here, and put them in a different process that doesn't have the same rights is extremely dangerous to our own traditions.
Time for one or two more. Yes, you had a question.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Hussein. I'm just wondering what any and all of you think the relevance or role of U.S. citizenship or U.S. legal residence should be or could be in the case either of a preventative detention regime or a national security court.
Jack, I think you've addressed that.
So I argued in my Brookings paper that any detention scheme created by Congress should extend to U.S. citizens and that we shouldn't draw a distinction between aliens and U.S. citizens for two reasons. One, I know that's going to be politically very controversial and probably a non-starter, but any detention system that we design for U.S. citizens will be one that is, let's just put it, much fairer than one we just, anyone that we're confident enough with, the Congress is confident enough with, for to detain U.S. citizens as member of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, would be one that would be we'd be confident in for aliens. And in general would also be much more legitimate in the eyes of the world whose citizens we are detaining. One of the great, one of the many reasons why our allies don't like our detention system is because it just applies to, we have this double standard. We don't have confidence enough in the system to apply it to U.S. citizens. And I don't think we should have a scheme that draws that distinction. We should be confident enough to apply it to U.S. citizens. And by the way, every time the DNI or the Attorney General for the last 3 or 4 years goes up before Congress, he has said that the threat of a serious terror attack in the United States could come from a U.S. citizen just as much as a non-U.S. citizen. So that's my view on that.
Just really quickly, I mean, I actually agree with Jack entirely as a policy matter that if we actually treated all terrorism suspects alike, the odds are much greater that we would think more carefully about how we did it. It's important, though, to keep in mind Justice Scalia's dissent in Hamdi, which surprised certainly a lot of people.
Stevens.
It was less surprising that it was Stevens, right?
But it was a dissent.
And, right.
Got two votes.
It was a dissent, but if you read the tea leaves, there would have been five votes in Padilla. I mean, I think there's at least the argument, right? Whether it has more than two votes, that citizens are special under the Constitution, right? That there's a way in which the only way you can detain a citizen without criminal charges, at least according to Justice Scalia, is to validly suspend habeas corpus. Otherwise, you have to try them with treason. Now, I think that goes to I know Jack disagrees with that argument. I think that goes to the last question about how far we're going to go to extend other constitutional protections to, you know, non-citizen terrorism suspects? And I think the answer to that is we first have to understand what the constitutional protections are, right? Due process varies. Right, the notion that citizens have due process rights abroad does not mean they're the same due process rights that they have here, right? There's a Second Circuit decision, from last fall, that says the warrant clause doesn't apply, of the Fourth Amendment, doesn't apply extraterritorial, because how can you go to a judge? So I think to ask whether we're gonna give equal rights, right, to citizens and non-citizens is to first require us to understand what the rights of citizens are when they are considered to be terrorism suspects overseas. And I think even that is a little hazier than we'd be comfortable with.
I think we're out of time. I'd like to thank all of you for coming. Thank our panelists for a fascinating discussion. And recommend to the Obama administration that if they can get the panelists to agree on any